We were discussing Julius Wellhausen and his theories and the impact of those theories on the historical material of the Old Testament. I tried to briefly outline his documentary source hypothesis for you, JEDP theory as it's known, in the last class hour. And pretty much goes on a line like that, as we noticed. J being earliest, P being latest, D being at 621, which was the time of Josiah and finding of the law book. These other dates, 721 is the fall of the northern kingdom, 586 the fall of the southern kingdom, two key dates in the history of Israel. Of course, here's the Exodus, time of David. Ezra is in the time of the exile. So along that kind of a timeline, according to Wellhausen, the material that makes up the Pentateuch was developed over a long period of time, starting with J, followed by E, then D, finally P, with a series of redactors that combine the material so that the end result is a mosaic of materials. And his claim was that many of the concepts and ideas that are attributed to early times really are not legitimately to be considered as having existed then, but rather they reflect the late times in which these sources were written. So that, as I mentioned, I think at the end of the hour, something like circumcision, covenant, election, attributed to the patriarchs, really ideas that existed in the time of the exile, included in P's writing, projected back into the earlier time, completely distorting the earlier history. I gave, I think, a couple other illustrations. I think right at the end of the hour, someone asked a question about monotheism, and I mentioned that he viewed religion developing from polytheism to henotheism to monotheism. That's also in line with this evolutionary concept of the development of religions generally. Let me give you another pattern that he spoke about. He discerned what he termed natural religion, which was primitive worship reflected in the J.E. sources. Natural religion, primitive worship, reflected in these two earlier sources, J and E. Then prophetic religion, which developed ethical consciousness, which he found reflected in the D source. Prophetic religion, ethical consciousness in the D source. And then priestly religion with external ceremonial rites, which he attributed to the P source. So you see there's another developmental kind of scheme. Natural religion, the prophetic religion, the priestly religion. And he aligns that with the progression of these sources. Now remember, these sources are imaginary. There has never been any documentary evidence of the existence of these things in isolation, what he labels J, what he labels E, B, and P. So it's a hypothesis. But it's a hypothesis that many people feel he pretty well established, and therefore it's been accepted by many people in the mainstream contemporary scholarship, or ever since the time of Wellhausen. I'm not going to take the time in this class, not the purpose of this class, go into the details of his theory and try to argue the points and refute them. You're going to do that in Old Testament introduction. Our purpose here is to see the impact of the theory on the history writing of the Old Testament. What it does is result in a very low view of the historical material of the Old Testament, because, as I said, there are a lot of distortions, if not outright fabrications involved in the historical material because of his theory. Now, Scopa, yes. That's right. That's right. That's right. You're right. A long time after, for the very first, the earliest material, after the time of David. David's about 1,000. Moses about 1,400. Yes. All right, let's go just a little bit further with this, and then we'll move on to something else. For Wellhausen and his followers, their interest was not in the message of the Old Testament. Their major concern was to reconstruct, by their historical critical method, what they considered to be the history of Israel's religious development. The interest was not in the message, but it was in reconstructing the history of Israel's religious development. And that was done on this evolutionary scheme. Now, it's interesting that Wellhausen was teaching in the theological faculty at a university in Germany, a place called Greifswald, Greifswald. And he came to the conclusion that he really should resign from that position because he did not feel that what he was teaching was the kind of thing that would prepare men for the ministry. And in this little book, which is mentioned on your bibliography, let's see, top of page 2, the fourth entry, Walter Zimmerli, The Law and the Prophets. He speaks of Wellhausen on page 22. That notation is on that bibliography. He says this. In 1982, he was called as a professor to the theological faculty in Greifswald. In the 10 years spent in Greifswald, he wrote his decisive studies on the literary criticism of the Old Testament. In 1882, he resigned from his professorship in the theological faculty. The letter to the ministerium in which he tendered his resignation is an impressive testimony to the integrity of this great man. He writes in this letter, quote, "I became a theologian because I was interested in the scientific treatment of the Bible. It has only slowly dawned upon me that a professor of theology has at the same time the task of preparing students for service in the Protestant church, and that I am not adequate to perform this practical task. Since then, my theological professorship has weighed heavily on my conscience." End of quote. That's from a letter of his resignation. So Zimmerli says, thus Wellhausen retired on grounds of conscience from his theological professorship and accepted the appointment of extraordinary professor for Semitic languages in Halle at another university. But he was there forbidden to teach Old Testament because of his awesome reputation as a literary critic. Now, the point I want to make about this is, I think Wellhausen saw the issue. And I would agree with Zimmerli that he showed some integrity in resigning. The problem is, the people who accepted his ideas continued to take positions in theological schools, and particularly in this country, many professors in seminaries and graduate schools of religion went to Germany, studied under Wellhausen students, if you get up to the contemporary time, accept the ideas and go back and perpetuate them in the context of the theological school. And, of course, what that has led to is the liberalism, a lot of the mainline denominations and seminaries in this country. So that if they would follow Wellhausen in his resignation as well as in adopting his ideas, the American church scene would be way ahead. But that didn't happen. He resigned. They didn't. But the end result is the message of the Old Testament was lost, and it was replaced with an attempt to reconstruct a history of Israel's religion on an evolutionary basis. The message is lost. Replace that with an attempt to reconstruct a history of Israel's religion on an evolutionary basis. Really what you're interested in from the Wellhausen perspective is a history of religions kind of approach to the Old Testament. All right, let's go back to your outline sheet. That's a brief survey of critical views. A, Julius Wellhausen. B, is the rise of form criticism. And I have two subheads there. One is Herman Gunkel, and two is Gerhard von Rad. First, just a general comment on form criticism. Since Wellhausen's time, late 1800s, early 1900s, there have been many modifications and refinements of his approach to Old Testament literature. But the basic thesis that he developed, and that's that sequence of J, E, D, P, has remained intact. And you may hear people today say, well, Wellhausen's outdated now, we've gone way beyond Wellhausen. There's a sense in which that is true. But underneath, a lot of the developments that have been piled on top of that remains intact, that basic sequence, and the acceptance of the division of Pentateuch particularly into sources that are labeled J, E, D, and P. That remains pretty much intact. It still does till this day. You don't have to read very far in contemporary literature to find that that's true. That's the way things are. Probably the most significant change since Wellhausen in critical studies of the Old Testament is the development of form criticism. What form criticism does is give an added dimension to the documentary hypothesis. Now, I'll have to explain what I mean by that. It gives an added dimension to the documentary hypothesis. With form criticism, or at least with most practitioners of it, the source analysis of Wellhausen's JEDP theory is accepted. Form criticism doesn't reverse any of that or reject any of that. It's accepted, that source analysis. But the idea of form criticism is to penetrate behind the documents to the oral tradition, which was thought to be crystallized in the document. In other words, the idea, here's the J document. All right, we've isolated that, we accept that. But what we want to do is get back behind J to the antecedents of it in oral tradition. It finally became crystallized in that J document. Now, I'll come back to that in a minute. Herman Gunkel was the key figure in the development of this approach to the analysis of the literature of the Old Testament. And he's number one on your sheet under form criticism. Herman Gunkel lived 1862 to 1932. Now, you know, compare that with Wellhausen, 1844 to 1918. They overlapped a lot. But you might say Gunkel's a younger contemporary of Wellhausen. He brings this up to 1932. William Foxwell Albright, who is an American Oriental scholar, Near Eastern scholar. I don't know if that name means much to you. He taught for years. He's now dead at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. He's a very influential American scholar. He says of Gunkel, he's one of the most remarkable scholars of modern times. He says his approach to biblical materials, his methodology in delineating their character and purpose have been appropriated in one fashion or another by all who move in the mainstream of contemporary biblical studies. So that's just one person, or prominent person's, assessment of the influence of Gunkel. His methodologies have been accepted by all who are in the mainstream of contemporary biblical study. Gunkel introduced to biblical study several terms that have become just commonplace. Let me give them to you. They're German terms. But if you read any technical literature, you probably come across them. The first one is Gattung, which means literary type in German. Gattung. In parenthesis, I have the French term equivalent genre, because you'll read in technical studies sometimes the term Gattung, sometimes the term genre, but usually one of the two is used. What it means is a literary type, a genre of literature, Gattung of literature, particular literary type. Second term, very important in Gunkel's system, and we'll see how in a minute, is the German expression Sitz im Leben. Sitz im Leben. If you translate it rather literally, it's situation in life. Situation in life. And the final form, or the final term, is Formgeschichte. Now that's one word. It looks like there's a space there, but form is form, just like in English. Geschichte is history. But in German, it's one word. German often multiplies words together and makes longer words with them. History of forms. Now, as I mentioned just a minute ago, the idea of form criticism was not to discard the literary documents, J, D, and P, but try to penetrate behind them to the antecedent oral traditions. And what Gunkel felt was that what you needed to do was within each of these documents, you have the J document, the E, D, and P, within each of them, you need to isolate smaller story units, individual story units. And you knew you needed to categorize them according to their Gattung. In other words, you had to, with each little story unit, decide what literary type it represented. And then you needed to work at what sits in Leben, what situation in life would produce that kind of a literary type. What situation in life, what sits in Leben would give rise to each individual literary type? And this process was Formgeschichte, study of the history of forms, literary forms. So what Gunkel wanted to do was to get behind the documents to what he felt were the influences and settings which were the sources of the literature. Now, couple things about Gunkel's methodology. One is, there's something more positive in what Gunkel does than Wellhausen, in the sense that he recognizes the antiquity of much in these JEDP documents that Wellhausen didn't. In other words, Wellhausen regarded those stories as the written creations of the authors, the J author, the E author, the P author, etc. Whereas and then projected back into antiquity. Whereas Gunkel felt that J was the final result of a long process of passing down of tradition originally in an oral form till it finally came into a final written form. So that what you have with Gunkel is at least a recognition that some of the components of these documents are much older than what we see in the final form, in the document itself. So that what you get, is if you try to diagram it, is something like this. See, Wellhausen has that timeline. And the J writer was 950 to 850, E writer 850 to 750, and so on. I said, with Gunkel, you get an added dimension to the documentary hypothesis. That's what I meant by it, was this. Here you have the same timeline, Exodus, David, 721, 586, Ezra, you see down there in the bottom. Before the time of David, he didn't feel there were any written traditions. They were all oral. The various people that made up Israel, and he didn't feel it was a homogeneous unit, but they came from various backgrounds, brought oral traditions with them. And they all sort of coalesced eventually about the time of David in this nation of Israel. And then out of those oral traditions, you had a process of molding certain ones of them into what became the J document over a period of time. And you had a process of molding others into what became the E document. You had a separate line of tradition running into D and a separate running into P. And you see, he extends this out over a period of time. And so gradually you have the J document being formed, the E. You again get a redactor JE at about the same time, around 621. Meantime, the D document is being formulated, and the P document, and finally, all three are put together. So instead of a simple timeline sort of thing, you get a sort of more complex situation where each of these documents has its own history, you might say, before it is fused with the other documents. Think of the question. Yeah.
So it's a big block. Would you consider that a time of writing, or is that a correlation of writing?
Probably some of both. Some of these stories that were oral may have been put into writing, but they may have existed then in written form as a separate story unit, and then a bunch of separate story units gradually. This is part of this theory. You got the story units strung together in some sort of sequence, but that took a period of time to complete. In doing that, the idea was a lot of these story units, say take the sequence of stories with Abraham. You may have had stories, according to this kind of a theory, that had quite different antecedents originally. But gradually, they got related to each other. They got subsumed under the same name, Abraham, and arranged into sort of a narrative flow. There was a lot of reconstruction of the stories, modification of the stories, et cetera, in that process. But it was a long process that did that. But what you don't have, then, is a J writer at 950, really with a J that's not as far removed, but say here with Phi, you don't have a P writer at 450 sitting down with no antecedent material to work with. And just the professor that I had in Amsterdam had a Dutch expression that I'll translate here, just sucking it out of his thumb. Now, you don't have a writer sitting down and doing that. You have a writer that's working with antecedent traditions. And those traditions themselves have a long history. But to get back to the Gunkel theory, he felt that if you could isolate the story units and label them as a certain literary type, Gattel and genre, you could then theorize what kind of situation in life produced that kind of a story type. And that was sort of the methodology he used to analyze these stories. And we'll see how he went about it in a few minutes. Well, that's one thing. There's more antiquity to the material with Gunkel than there was with Wellhausen. The other thing is, as far as this matter of literary type and situation life that produces a literary type, there's a certain legitimacy to that as an idea, at least in the abstract. You can think in modern literature, there are all kinds of different styles to writing. If you compare a telegram with a textbook, there's quite a different literary style. And you compare that with a love letter, and compare that with an advertisement, and you compare that with, say, a diplomatic communique. The literary style is quite different in all those forms of writing. And there's a particular situation in life that produces a love letter, an advertising brochure, whatever. So you can look at a piece of writing and say, oh, well, that's this genre of writing, and it must have been created in this kind of a context. So there's a certain legitimacy to that as an idea. And in literary analysis, of course, that can play a role. With Gunkel, and particularly with a lot of his followers, the way in which he used that idea is something else, because it goes into so much hypothetical and imaginary kind of reconstruction of situations in life that produce literature that it becomes very arbitrary.
I've also heard the term higher criticism.
Yeah.
Okay. Where does that end?
Lower criticism is concerned with the text. In other words, if you get a copy of the Greek New Testament or the Hebrew Old Testament, you have a good copy, a critical edition with footnotes that will compare manuscripts. And where there are slight differences between one manuscript or another manuscript, you compare them, and there are certain methods that can be used to try to establish what the original text was. In the process of transmission, you get certain divergences. That's lower criticism, working back to establish original text. Higher criticism is concerned with authorship and date of authorship. And that kind of analysis. This is higher criticism.
Okay.
Two streams of criticism, higher and lower. And with higher criticism in itself has come to have a pejorative sense, the term, because as practiced, an influence, its influence has been largely negative because it's been destructive. But there's a very real place for higher criticism to look into biblical literature and try to ascertain the place, time, setting, author, etc. That is higher criticism. It can be done the right way or wrong way. All right, on your bibliography sheet, under page 2, under the Gunkel heading, that's Roman 1, capital B, Arabic 1, small b, parenthesis 1, right in the middle of the page. The entry is by H.F. Hahn, The Old Testament and Modern Research. I want to quote from H.F. Hahn. And you notice that's from chapter 4 of that book. It's this little book, which is a very useful book, The Old Testament and Modern Research, because it summarizes the last century of research into the Old Testament. And chapter 4 is on form criticism. But Hahn says, Gunkel believed that the literary genius of a primitive people first expressed itself in myths about the origins of things. In myths, gods are the primary actors. And in legends about the exploits of folk heroes. In legends, men are the primary actors. So Gunkel felt you have myths and legends. Myths, gods, the primary action, the actor. Legends, heroes of the people. Men are the primary actors. He turned to the narratives of Genesis for the earliest examples of this sort of popular tradition among the Hebrews. He assumed, furthermore, that popular legend, by its very nature, takes the form of the individual story rather than the extended narration. And thus he reduced the narratives of Genesis to separate literary units. These, he argued, had existed independently in recitation and song long before they were written down in their present form. Even the grouping of the stories into story cycles, such as Genesis, contains, was in Gunkel's view, first done in the pre-literary stage. So I've already indicated something though. Break it down into story units, identify what kind they are, and that was the process. Now, for Gunkel, the narratives of Genesis were legend, not history. He wrote a book, which is also there in that same section on your bibliography, entitled The Legends of Genesis. The Legends of Genesis. Now, when you hear someone say, Genesis is legend, it's not history, probably provokes a negative reaction, rightly so. Gunkel tries to argue against that. Here's what he says on page 2 of The Legends of Genesis. He says, the senseless confusion of legend with lying has caused good people to hesitate to concede that there are legends in the Old Testament. But legends are not lies. On the contrary, they are a particular form of poetry. Why should not the lofty spirit of Old Testament religion, which employed so many varieties of poetry, indulge in this form also? For religion everywhere, the Israelite religion included, has especially cherished poetry and poetic narrative, since poetic narrative is much better qualified than prose to be the medium of religious thought. Genesis is a more intensely religious book than the Book of Kings. Now, what he's saying is, the narratives of Genesis are legend, which he labels as poetry, and says that's a better medium for transmitting religious thought than is prose or history. And he says, for that reason, Genesis is a more religious book than is the Book of Kings, which he would classify as history. A little later on page 3, he says, the objection is raised that Jesus and the apostles clearly considered these accounts to be fact and not poetry. Know what his response is? Suppose they did. The men of the New Testament are not presumed to have been exceptional men in such matters, but shared the point of view of their time. Hence, we are not warranted in looking to the New Testament for a solution of questions about the literary history of the Old Testament. So that testimony of Christ and the apostles, that has anything to do, any bearing on the character of the narratives of Genesis? He says that's irrelevant. They're just children of their time. It was thought in that time that this was history. They accepted that view. He dismisses it that quickly. He then goes on to enumerate a number of criteria for distinguishing legend from history. I'll come back to this a bit later. I won't go through all those criteria. But the most important one is on page 7. He says the clearest criterion of legend is that it frequently reports things that are quite incredible. The clearest criterion is it reports things which are quite incredible. And as he develops that with respect to Genesis, he says, however cautious the modern historian may be in declaring anything impossible, he may declare with all confidence that animals, serpents and she-asses, for instance, do not speak and never have spoken, that there's no tree whose fruit confers immortality or knowledge, that angels and men do not have carnal connection, and that a world-conquering army cannot be defeated, as Genesis 14 declares, with 318 men. Now, he uses a number of illustrations there, either which are straw men or miraculous, and attempts to establish incredibility as a criteria for separating the material of Genesis as legend, separating it from history. Certainly, in evaluating historical material, credibility is not to be dismissed. We do that all the time. If we read a newspaper account, we apply the criteria of credibility. You want to look at credibility. You just don't want to dismiss it. It is important. But when you come to biblical narrative, you certainly cannot determine whether it's legend or history by assuming in advance the impossibility of the miraculous. And that's at the heart of Gunkel's methodology. See, that's an a priori. That's something he has begun with. Miracles don't happen. Why don't they happen? Well, we haven't experienced them. Therefore, they don't happen. And if miracles don't happen, then any story that contains one is not history. See, that's the line of reasoning. And his starting point is where he's wrong. The starting point rests on a principle of analogy, principle of historical analogy. Anything you haven't experienced in your own history is something that doesn't happen. And it certainly, we'll come back to this later, it's certainly improper when dealing with biblical material, which sets itself out to represent itself as a record of God's intervention in human history to bring about redemption. If that's what it is, you can't do justice to that material if you rule out the possibility of divine intervention from the start. See, the two are in total conflict. Yes?
Did Gunkel believe, once you pull all the miraculous stuff out, mm-hmm. did he believe what was that?
He believed it was history. Well, he would feel there were elements of history that probably were there, but overlaid and intermixed with much that wasn't. His point was not so much that. See, it gets back to this question, how important is history? How important is it that these things happen? To him, it wasn't so important. What he was interested in was the religious message or lessons that we could learn from these stories. It was sort of like Aesop's fables. Nobody would say they happened, but you can moralize them. Let me go a bit further. Page 10, where he talks about legend being poetry further. He says, the important point is and will remain the poetic tone of the narrative. History, which claims to inform us of what has actually happened, is in its very nature prose, while legend is by nature poetry. Its aim being to please, to elevate, to inspire, to move. He who wishes to do justice to such narratives must have some aesthetic faculty to catch in the telling of a story what it is and what it purports to be. And in doing so, he's not expressing a hostile or even skeptical judgment, but simply studying lovingly the nature of his material. Whoever possesses heart and feeling must perceive, for instance, in the case of the sacrifice of Isaac, that the important matter is not to establish certain historical facts. Not Gunkel's opinion. That's not the purpose of the story, to tell you what happened. But to impart to the hearer the heart-rending grief of the father who was commanded to sacrifice his child with his own hand, and then his boundless gratitude and joy when God's mercy releases him from this grievous trial. And everyone who perceives the peculiar poetic charm of these old legends must feel irritated by the barbarian. Notice this. For there are pious barbarians who thinks he is putting the true value upon these narratives only when he treats them as prose and history. Catch that? If you treat those Genesis narratives as prose and history, as telling you what happened, according to Gunkel, you're a barbarian. In other words, you don't have the aesthetic quality to see the poetry. Pardon? Exactly. That's what he would call it. Okay. The second chapter of this book is on the varieties of legends in Genesis. The varieties of legends. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but just a few more illustrations. And I already have this terminology here that maybe you were wondering what was all about. Gunkel considers most of the legends in Genesis to be etiological legends. Etiological legends. What's that mean? Etiology is the study of cause. Etiology is the study of cause. It's a term often used in connection with disease. What's the etiology of a disease? And you study what brings a certain disease about. As applied to the legends of Genesis, it means that the legends explain why something is as it is presently observed. A legend will explain why something is as it is presently observed. Now, we'll illustrate that, and I think that'll become clearer. There are a number of different types of etiological legends, according to Gunkel. Remember I said he wanted to isolate the story units and then label them according to literary type. These are some of the types of etiological legends. The first is ethnological. Pages 25 to 27. He says there is a desire to know the reasons for the relations of tribes. Why is Canaan the servant of his brethren? Why has Japheth such an extended territory? Why do the children of Lot dwell in the inhospitable east? See that you could observe that these things existed, that Lot, children of Lot dwelt here, Japheth had an extended territory, etc. Why is that as it is? How does it come that Reuben has lost his birthright? Why must Cain wander about a restless fugitive? Why does Bathsheba belong to us and not to the people of Gerar? Why has Ishmael become a Bedouin people with just this territory? So forth. Well, he says that stories were evolved to explain things, to answer these questions. And that such stories are ethnological legends. They answer why something is as it is observed to be. But they're fictitious. He says, such ethnological legends which tell a fictitious story in order to explain tribal relations are, of course, difficult to distinguish from historical legends, which contain the remnant of a tradition of some actual event. But for the most part, his ethnological legends were fictitious stories to explain relationships of peoples and why they lived where they did or why they were who they were. He says, childish as these explanations now seem to us, it was, and as impossible as it was for men of old to find out the true reasons for such things, yet we must not overlook the profundity of many of these poetic legends. Etymological legends. They had to do with the origin and meaning of names and races, mountains, wells, sanctuaries, and cities. Origin and meaning of names. Now, he illustrates this with a couple of popular etymologies. And remember, he wrote this in German. This has been translated into English. And he uses some German illustrations. But then he uses a couple English ones. He says, we too have our popular etymologies. How many there are who believe that the noble river, which runs down between New Hampshire and Vermont and across Massachusetts and Connecticut, is so named because it connects the first two and cuts the latter two states, Connecticut River. Is that why the Connecticut River is called what it is? It's a fictitious story to explain the meaning of a name. And he feels that some of the stories that explain meanings of names that are found in Pentateuch are, by analogy, the same kind of fictitious explanation. Here's another one. Manhattan Island, it is said, was named from the exclamation of a savage who was struck by the size of a Dutch hat worn by an early burgher. Manhattan. Numerous in Genesis. The city of Babel is named from the fact that God there confused human tongues, Balaam, Genesis 11:9. Jacob is interpreted as heel holder because at birth he held his brother, whom he robbed of his birthright, by the heel, so forth and so on. So that what he's saying is a lot of those stories that explain the meaning of names are every bit as fictitious as Manhattan. So again, you see what this does to historicity. It completely destroys it. This is not history. But then you see, he comes back. He says, if you read it as history, you're a barbarian. You don't have the aesthetic, poetic insight to understand. Ceremonial legends. There are a lot of these, he says, that explain regulations of religious ceremonials. When children see their father perform all sorts of curious customs during the Feast of the Passover, they will ask. Thus it is expressly told, Exodus 12:26. What does this mean? And then the story of the Passover will be told them. A similar direction is given with relation to the 12 stones in the Jordan, Joshua 4:6, which the father is to explain to the children as memorials of the passage through the Jordan. In these examples, we see clearly how such a legend is the answer to a question. Why do we do this at the Passover? Well, the story of the Passover then is told. And that's to explain a contemporary ritual. And he says it's the same with regard to the origin of circumcision, with the Sabbath, and so forth. He says, no Israelite could have given the real reason for all these things, for they were too old. But to relieve this embarrassment, myth and legend step in. They tell a story and explain the sacred custom. Long ago, an event occurred from which this ceremony very naturally sprang. And you get the story of the origin of the Passover, or whatever. Those are what he calls ceremonial legends. Geological legends, we'll stop with that, explains the origin of a locality. Whence comes the Dead Sea with its dreadful desert? Well, the region was cursed by God on account of the terrible sin of its inhabitants. Whence comes the pillar of salt yonder with its resemblance to a woman? That is a woman, Lot's wife, turned into a pillar of salt in punishment for attempting to spy out the mystery of God. Geological legend. Now, as you can see from all this, for Gunkel, what actually happened is not the important thing in the biblical story. What he's interested in is the message that's conveyed by the story. The message which is conveyed by the story. He says in the volume that's listed on your bibliography, which is the only other volume that has been translated into English of Gunkel, interesting title. What Remains of the Old Testament? Good question with this method. But he says in that volume, page 20, think of the force with which in the Cain story murder is set forth as the basal crime. The charm of the Joseph story, eloquent of fraternal envy and fraternal love, full of faith and an overruling providence. The attractiveness of the Ruth idol, exhibiting a widow's love lasting beyond death and the grave. The magnificent solemnity of the creation narrative, the wondrous story of paradise, naive yet profound. He says the creation story, valuable as its religious thoughts still are, is for us not actual history. And so forth. What he got from these stories were the magnificent religious concepts that he felt were embedded in these stories. The power of God, divine rule and providence, divine retribution of good and evil, religious emotion, that sort of thing. That's the value of the Old Testament. Those religious concepts and emotions that are conveyed in the stories. Not what happened. He's really not interested in what happened. This methodology all but precludes you from ever determining what happened. I want to say just a little more about Gunkel again in the next hour, and we'll go on to the next fellow, Von Rock. Okay?